U.S. health authorities are lifting a pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
They've determined the dangers of catching COVID-19 outweigh the risks of rare side effects from the vaccine.
I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro.
And I'm Scott Simon, and this is Up First from NPR News. We'll look at that decision from the Centers for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration also.
This summit is a start.
President Biden convened leaders from 40 countries to talk about climate change and rolls out new targets to control global warming.
And the president today is expected to declare that the massacre of Armenians more than a century ago was genocide. That could further strain relations with Turkey.
So stay with us. We've got the news you need to start your weekend.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Salesforce, dedicated to helping growing businesses connect their teams, share information, and automate processes all in a single app. Learn more at salesforce.com/SMB.
The Johnson & Johnson coronavirus vaccine is back in use in the U.S.
Last night, officials from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Food and Drug Administration lifted a pause on the vaccine. They determined that the danger of catching COVID-19 outweigh the risks of some very rare but serious side effects.
NPR's Ping Huang joins us to fill us in on some of those details. Ping, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
This is big news. And Johnson & Johnson vaccinations are resuming as early as today?
That's right. Now that the pause is lifted, vaccinations can start up again, and the FDA has already updated the instructions for healthcare providers and information for patients, explaining that there's a potential risk for a rare side effect. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky says she's pleased that the vaccinations can now continue.
The science supports this news, and I know that this is welcome news for many, as many have wanted the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to fill an important need in vaccination efforts here and around the world.
The J&J vaccine is just one shot. It can be stored for months at refrigerator temperatures, so it's much easier to keep and to administer.
It's been 12 days, of course, since the hold began. Please remind us, Ping, why they put that hold on it.
Well, it happened after six women who got the J&J vaccine got seriously ill. They developed a very rare condition called thrombosis with thrombocytopenia syndrome, TTS for short, and it basically means people getting severe blood clots with low platelet counts. And even though there were only six cases at the time, the pause allowed them to look for more. Here's Dr. Melinda Wharton, director of the CDC's Immunization Services Division.
I think there was a very important objective achieved by the pause, which is allowing clinicians to be informed about the condition, raising public awareness, and providing time to get a better assessment of risk.
During this pause, they told doctors and people who had gotten that shot recently to look out for symptoms like a bad headache or abdominal pain about a week after getting the shot.
Did they find more cases?
Yeah, a few. The CDC confirmed that TTS has now been found in 15 people. All of them were women, mostly in their mid-30s to late-30s, and some of them have recovered, but three have died. And the key message to doctors is to ask someone who presents with these symptoms whether they've gotten the J&J vaccine, and to not treat the condition with a common blood thinner called heparin, which could make the situation worse. An advisory committee to the CDC met all day yesterday to hear about these cases. They talked a lot about how they had been found in younger women, but ultimately decided not to put any restrictions on who should get the vaccine.
But should women who are in that age group think twice before they get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine?
Well, certainly the CDC wants people, and especially young women, to be aware of the risk. And there was some debate over whether there should be stronger warnings specifically for women under 50. Here's Dr. Jose Romero. He's health secretary for Arkansas and chair of the CDC's Vaccine Advisory Committee.
I acknowledge, as does everyone else, that these events are rare, but they are serious. It is our responsibility as clinicians to make sure that women understand this risk, and when possible, that they have an alternative at the same site that you're administering the vaccine.
Of course, not all sites will have a choice, but in the end, the CDC said that the J&J vaccine was found to be safe and effective in most people, and that adding this vaccine back to the mix in the U.S. would prevent around 1,400 deaths and 2,000 ICU admissions over the next 6 months.
NPR health reporter Ping Huang, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
The U.S. stepped back into the climate leadership spotlight this week. The Biden administration hosted a summit on climate change with 40 other countries.
And that's where President Biden pledged to dramatically reduce U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, and he encouraged other countries to do the same.
This summit is a start of a road that will take us to Glasgow for the U.N. Climate Change Conference in November, where we're going to make these commitments real.
NPR's Jeff Brady joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. What is Biden promising?
Well, the U.S. is committed to reducing greenhouse gases by 50 to 52% by the end of this decade. That's based on 2005 emissions. That's twice what President Obama pledged in 2015, and we weren't even on track to accomplish that. So this is very ambitious.
Very ambitious. So how does the Biden administration plan to achieve that in just 9 years?
This summit was about setting big goals. We'll get more details in coming months, but we do have some clues now. The administration wants a national clean energy standard that would require increasing amounts of electricity from sources that don't emit the climate warming gases fossil fuels do. Also, the president's infrastructure proposal, that would ramp up electric cars and build more transmission lines to get renewable energy to where it's needed. Cooperation from Congress is necessary to make those a reality. This is a huge undertaking, and Biden says the entire federal government is working on the climate issue now. One comment yesterday from the summit helped me better understand the scope of what's being undertaken here. The executive director of the International Energy Agency, Fatih Birol, said countries are starting down this road without even knowing how some emissions reductions will happen because the technology doesn't exist.
About half the reductions to get to net zero emissions in 2050 will need to come from technologies that are not yet ready for market today.
That's why in these pledges countries are making, especially wealthy countries, boosting research and development budgets is a big focus too.
All right, well, let's talk about those other countries. Did they also step up their goals?
A few announced more aggressive targets. Japan increased its emissions reduction goal to 46%. Canada boosted its target to at least 40%. The United Kingdom is the leader here. It plans to reduce emissions by 78% by 2035. China also said it'll try to limit a projected increase in coal use and then phase out coal-fired electricity. South Korea said it'll stop financing new coal power plants in other countries. And these may not sound as ambitious as the U.S. and U.K., but under the Paris Agreement, countries with long histories of emitting greenhouse gases, like the U.S. and the U.K., they're expected to be more ambitious early on. Countries like China and India that are just now emerging as big emitters get more time to phase down their fossil fuel use.
All right. The goal of the Paris Climate Agreement is to limit warming below 2 degrees Celsius, hopefully below 1.5. I mean, the big question is all of this enough to do that?
You know, it's not. Humans spent the last century plus removing carbon from underground and putting it up in the atmosphere. It's going to take an extraordinary effort to start reversing that. But this is a few steps in that direction, and countries have to trust each other to stick to their commitments, then come back again later and try to ratchet up those commitments even more.
That's NPR correspondent Jeff Brady. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lulu.
President Biden's expected to make a symbolic but important announcement today, recognizing the massacre of well over a million Armenians by Ottoman forces starting in 1915 as genocide. This is the day Armenians mark the 106th anniversary of that massive tragedy, observing Genocide Remembrance Day and urging governments to adopt the term that's already embraced by many historians.
Now, this might seem like an old conflict that doesn't have relevance today, but it is a huge issue because Turkey rejects the reference to genocide. It says the deaths were due to regional conflict during World War I. And Biden's announcement, if it comes, could strain U.S. relations with a NATO ally. NPR's Peter Kenyon joins us now from Istanbul for more on this. Good morning.
Hi, Lulu.
So previous administrations have largely tried to sidestep this decision in order not to upset Turkey. Why would President Biden be doing this now?
Right. Well, doing it on Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day would certainly be important symbolically. And this is an issue we campaigned on. A couple of years ago, both houses of Congress called for this recognition. But at the time, President Trump stuck to the U.S. position of not wanting to anger NATO ally Turkey. Dozens of other countries have already recognized the Armenian Genocide. But when a former U.S. ambassador to Armenia used the term genocide in the early 2000s, his career suffered. There have been other mentions. Decades ago, the Reagan White House issued a proclamation. It was actually about World War II Holocaust deaths, but it also referred to, quote, the genocide of the Armenians. But hearing it directly from the president on this day would definitely be important to Armenians and others.
At the time of these events, the term genocide hadn't yet been coined. So tell us the history of this.
Well, that's right. The word genocide came into usage in the 1940s. But back during World War I, the Ottoman Empire was on its last legs. It was losing territory in the Balkans. The empire was shrinking. There had been heavy wartime losses, well, in a lot of places, but certainly in Turkey as well. But what many historians have concluded is that beginning in 1915, there was a specific campaign by Ottoman Turkish forces that led to the killing or deportation of as many as a million or more Armenians, and that, they say, was the first genocide of the 20th century. Now, Turkey's never accepted either the size of the death toll or the idea that it committed genocide.
Well, that being the case, how could this be received in Turkey? You know, officials there have already been commenting just on the expectation that Biden might say something.
Right. If President Biden says it was genocide, that will not be welcome news. Turkey's foreign minister has already warned it could worsen bilateral ties. I think the strongest comment came from President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. His office released a statement saying Turkey would continue to fight the big Armenian genocide lie that he claimed had political motivations. Now, Erdogan is expected to stand for re-election here in a couple years, and considering his close ties to Turkey's ultra-nationalist party, I don't think this position is going to change anytime soon.
When you say it could strain relations, what exactly do you mean? What could happen between the U.S. and Turkey?
Well, that has been the subject of a fair bit of speculation. There are a few retaliatory measures Ankara could consider. There are air bases in Turkey used by the U.S. military. Some wonder if that access could be affected. But this would be coming when ties are already strained between the two countries. It's not clear President Erdogan would want to further alienate Washington when Turkey's economy seems to be in trouble. President Biden had his first phone call with Erdogan yesterday, but the Turkish coverage of that didn't even mention the Armenian issue, just a reference to, quote, effective management of disagreements. So ties are likely to get worse, but how bad and for how long, it bears watching.
That's NPR's Peter Kenyon in Istanbul. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lulu.
And that's Up First for Saturday, April 24th, 2021. I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro.
And I'm Scott Simon. Up First, back Monday with news to start your week. You can follow us on social media. We're at Up First on Twitter.
Indeed we are. And for more news, interviews, books, and music, you can find us on the radio.
The radio weekend edition, Saturday and Sunday mornings. You can find your NPR station at stations.npr.org.
I'm Yoe Shaw.
I'm Kia Miakonatis.
We're the hosts of the NPR podcast, Invisibilia.
You can think of Invisibilia kind of like a sonic blacklight.
When you switch us on, you will hear surprising and intimate stories.
Stories that help you notice things in your world that maybe you didn't see before.
Listen to the Invisibilia podcast from NPR.